Hello, everybody, and welcome to Feeling Seen, the podcast that talks about the movies that make us feel seen. I am joined today by someone who is generously had me on their podcast prior to this. Look at me. I'm getting tongue-tied. I'm getting over because I'm like, I'm already anticipating the conversation. This co-host, Elliot Kalin, an all-star of the Flophouse podcast, with a long entrenched and passionate fandom. The number of people who have in my life like messaged me after being on it, be like, "You're on the Flophouse podcast?" I'm like, "You've never talked about this thing that's apparently a big part of your life."
It's to me ever. It's a surprising thing. I'm always flattered by it, and I think it's wonderful, and I don't understand it. But I'll meet people at weddings or things like that, or I hear from my brother a lot. He's like, "Yeah, I met this my friend's new girlfriend, and she was like, 'Wait, are you David Kalin from the Flophouse podcast?'" And I'm like, "Yeah, it's America's favorite podcast that you've never heard of." Or it's like the Mystery Science Theater 3000, my favorite show of all time. I remember I once had it described to me as either it's your favorite show or you've never heard of it. And that's kind of the Flophouse also, I think, in some ways.
I think that's totally MST3K, and which is, speaking to your credits, you are a longtime writer for The Daily Show. I was looking at the credits, it's something around like 1,000 episodes that you worked on?
It was, at least, because, well, I mean, the thing about The Daily Show is you do almost 170 episodes a year. Yeah, but yeah, I was an intern there and a production assistant and a segment producer and then a writer and then the head writer for the last like year and a half of Jon Stewart's run.
And you are also writing and executive producing on, you said, your favorite show, Mystery Science Theater 3000, which feels like for you to say that is your favorite show. Now, this feels like a big deal for you. And one other thing I want to make sure we talked about, want to get it in. You write a comic, Maniac of New York. Mm-hmm. And the second collection of that is coming out in August. So you've got various irons in the fire. You're up to a lot of stuff.
The fire is always full of irons, and it's very tiring. There's a pun on tire iron in there, but I'm too tired from all these irons to think of it. But there's lots of stuff. And Maniac of New York, I think, will be, for people who are interested in our conversation today, it might be something that they find interesting as well, because it plays in, not exactly the same, but in a similar world, that a kind of violent New York world. Mm-hmm. But I've been lucky enough to do a lot of things I'm really excited about in my career. It's really great.
Now, also feeding into our conversation today, are you a native New Yorker?
I grew up in New Jersey, right outside of New York. Okay. And so my grandmother lived in New York. My mom was from New York and my dad was from White Plains. So not exactly, not the mean streets. But so I spent a lot of time in there. And growing up, it was like New York. That's where people go when they're adults. Like you're a kid in New Jersey and then you grow up and you go to New York. And there was a book that came out years ago called Never Can Say Goodbye that I have an essay in about watching movies about New York as a kid and being like, that's where you live as a grown-up. And, you know, the magic of The Muppets Take Manhattan and things like that. And the magic of seeing, like, Dana's apartment in Ghostbusters and things and being like, I could have an apartment like that someday. And then I lived in New York. I went to college there, and I lived there for about 17 years until I did say goodbye to New York and moved to Los Angeles almost 5 years. It'll be 5 years this summer. But it still feels like I went back to New York a month or so ago for a family wedding, and just walking around the city, I was like, oh yeah, I know this city. Like this is like, I feel like I get that city more than I get Los Angeles. Los Angeles, I'll never, it's going to take me longer to understand. So my heart is still in New York, you know?
We discussed today a classic piece of New York cinema, Taxi Driver.
Mm-hmm.
What a picture.
This is a movie, I watched it again for this podcast. I hadn't watched it in years, but when I was a young man, I must have seen it 20 times, you know, or if not more than that. And it was something that there was a coworker of mine at The Daily Show. We would see how many days we could go in a row with one or both of us quoting something from the movie because we knew it so well. And it's a movie that I remember when I talked to you about being on the podcast, I said, there's a lot of movies. I grew up feeling seen in movies. There's so many movies where like there's like a nerdy kid or a Jewish kid or something who like has an adventure or whatever. You know, like I grew up reading Spider-Man comics and Peter Parker is essentially me. So like I never had to worry about that. But that with Taxi Driver, I felt seen in a in a negative sense, which is kind of the aspects of me I was not proud of and was not happy with. Mm-hmm. And so, but from a, I think I first saw the movie when I was 13 or 14. And I
was going to ask, what was that age of impact?
And that was when, it was when I was 13 was when I really started getting into like movies. I'd always liked watching them. But 13 was when I was like, I'm going to be like a serious movie watcher. I'm going to watch all the movies I've always heard about. And I remember seeing Taxi Driver for the first time and just like feeling such a connection to it. And
it was immediate.
Yes,
like it was that first watch where you were like, this is different.
Yes.
Something's different.
And going into my 20s, it was, I still felt this connection to this movie. And like for a brief time in college, I considered shaving my head the way that he does near the end of the movie.
Of course.
Like I had a t-shirt with that image on it that I would wear. You know, and I was going to NYU. I remember being in an elevator with Spike Lee and him seeing that shirt and kind of rolling his eyes at it. And it's the only time I've ever encountered him. But I thought, I was like, oh, he thinks I'm just like... just another film student or whatever, which was
right.
the case at the time, I guess. But it wasn't until I got older that, and I never identified, it was like I always identified this character until he goes on his rampage at the end. Even when I was young, I knew that was too far. But it wasn't until I got older and I kind of matured that I started realizing, like, it's not a good thing that I identify so much with the way he feels before then. What I was feeling was represented in me was the loneliness and the anger, the potential for violence, which thankfully the internet didn't exist in the state that it is now when I was a teenager. So like I was not exposed to legions of other unhappy young men who wanted to hurt people. And like the feeling of, there's the thing that Roger Ebert says in one of his reviews of Taxi Driver, where he talks about a man who is drifting through a world that has women in it. And he wants to know one of these women, and he doesn't know how to do it. And he seems to be surrounded by men who know how to do it and do it effortlessly. Mm-hmm. And I remember living in New York basically until I met the woman who's my wife now. Like, and I would like date and things, but it felt like I was surrounded by people, not just men, but women also, who kind of like were just swimming naturally through this kind of like sea of sex and affection and physical connection and emotional connection. And I just like didn't know how to, and I'm walking along the bottom of the ocean floor. I don't know how to swim and I'm not drowning, but I don't know how to get to the layer of the ocean that they're at. And I remember, I feel like this movie, I never felt more like Travis Bickle than there was a moment when I was on Houston and Broadway. So I must've been leaving like Angelica Film Center. I must've just seen a movie. And there was a guy who was making out with his girlfriend and grabbing her butt, and I was standing behind her, and so he and I had locked eyes for a moment, and he just kept locking eyes with me while he made out with this woman and like groped her. And I remember at the moment, it felt like the entire universe was like, yeah, you want this really badly, but you can't have it. You don't get it. Like, this is not something you're gonna get. You're not, and so.
And I feel like that guy felt that coming off of you, which is why he was like
why he did
flexing on you in that moment.
And
it,
looking back, and I wonder, like, what is it in that guy's mind that he felt like his pleasure was increased by connecting with someone who didn't have it in that moment, and that like it wasn't enough that he was making out with somebody, that he had to like, he was more engaged with me in that moment than he was with the woman he was which is strange. But anyway, so like that was the part of me that
she was the thing facilitating the moment he was having with
yes,
you.
Yes, exactly. So, which is creepier than me at that moment.
That
but it was that feeling was what I, and I felt it again watching the movie again this time. It was like, oh, I remember feeling like this character. And unfortunately, I am not a seriously damaged man in the way that Robert De Niro is in this, that Travis Bickle is in this movie. But I still felt that loneliness. But it wasn't until watching the movie this time that I was like, wait a minute, I'm not Travis Bickle, but there is a character in this movie that I feel seen by, and it's Tom, Albert Brooks's character.
Albert Brooks? I was going to say, is it Albert Brooks?
Yeah, the guy who is a jokey guy who's involved in politics and is also not dating Sybil Shepherd, but like...
It's very much not dating Sybil Shepherd's Betsy.
I'll tell you what, I'll play the male in this relationship. I'll go out and tell him to move. And I don't need good luck. Thank you.
Oh, yes, you do. You just think you don't.
But I was like, oh, this guy is like, he has a job. He's called by his first name by a powerful person, by a senator running for president. Like, he's someone who has a life, even if you can tell he doesn't have the fantasy life he probably has. Like, Albert Brooks does so much to, the casting of Albert Brooks in that role does so much to make that role something that it isn't. And
absolutely.
I was like, oh, I'm Tom. Like, that's a much better person for me to be. Like, Tom is going to get married and have a family and a career and like not have a psychic break and go on a rampage where he murders people, you know?
Yeah. And I, Taxi Driver, the story of Travis Bickle.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I should have let you say the plot.
No, not at all. It vacillates how the plot comes up in the show.
Yeah.
I will break in and say that it is the story of a man looking for a job. He wants to work a lot. He wants to work long hours. And we open with him going to a cab company and being like, can I drive? I want to stay busy. And he works the night shift driving a cab in the city. He's very angry. He is a veteran.
He's deeply racist in a way that I was not as a young man. And I still am.
Yeah, he's racist. He's homophobic.
Yeah.
He absolutely equates like the fairies and the queens with criminals and like the underworld. And
there's not a single scene with a black person in the movie where he does not instantly put his guard up. Even his coworker, who is black, who lends him money and then he pays him back. And like I never sympathized with. But like he says to the taxi, he's not the dispatcher, but the person running the taxi cab company or hiring, he's like, I just got to work nights. I can't sleep.
I can't sleep nights. So what do you do now? Ride around nights, mostly subways, buses, I'm gonna do that. I might as well get paid for it.
Want to wake up town tonight? South Bronx, Harlem?
I'll work anytime, anywhere.
He's basically saying, like, I'm gonna fill this emptiness in my life with work because I don't know what, with work and going to porn theaters because that's all I know how to do. And I could just stay there forever. And it was like, I remember the moment when I was a teenager or an adolescent where I was like, I'm an unhappy person. So I don't have to think about that. I'm gonna watch movies and I'm gonna focus on that and focus on comedy because comedy will take me out of this unhappiness for a second. While I'm laughing. And so like what that porno theater is for taxi drivers calling him is if I'm an old man who calls the characters on their first name.
For the taxi and he uses the Google.
So when Taxi Driver goes to this thing, you know. Anyway, I was watching that movie where Leonardo DiCaprio plays Titanic when like Travis Bickle going to those porno theaters, like that was me as a college student with Film Forum. I would be like, I don't have anything to do today. I guess I'm going to Film Forum and I'm watching like three movies in their like Crime of the 40s series, or something like that. The need to fill time because you don't have a purpose or like human relationships to fill that time with. Like
He says explicitly. There is a line that Travis has explicitly where he's like, if only like I had a purpose.
Yeah.
All my life needed was a sense of someplace to go. I don't believe that one should devote his life to morbid self-attention. I believe that someone should become a person like other people.
This purposelessness is something that is grave and severe for him. It is inescapable. And he finds himself pouring into this. The thing that really got me when I was watching it last night was how suddenly I realized, I was like, wow, that what I'm watching Travis Bickle do in this movie now feels like a familiar arc that we see as a media narrative over and over and over again. Like the radicalization of a Travis Bickle, like in something that I have to assume, I've seen a lot of movies, haven't seen them all, but like I have to assume that a part of what makes this movie a classic and a part of what like built its legacy is that when it arrived in 1976, obviously filmmaker Martin Scorsese, I think he's like, Scorsese's in the movie as a man in a cab whose woman is cheating on him and he's planning to kill her lover.
He shows up, he shows up two times in the movies. He shows up in that scene where apparently the actor they had hired just didn't show up or called in sick, so he had to do it. There's a part where the first time Travis sees Betsy, Civil Shepherd's character, who he becomes enamored of and takes on at a date, and she goes out with him more out of curiosity, I think, than anything else. And then he takes her to a porno movie, and she storms out, and he gets mad. The first time he sees her, she's walking into this campaign office that she works in, and Martin Scorsese is sitting there right on the steps of the office watching her as she walks in. And there's a very Scorsese Catholic reading where it's like, oh, well, he's the devil. And in that moment, he is producing the situation to tempt Travis down a road, and then when he gets in the cab, he's going to be the one who introduces the idea of shooting people, of killing people, so
he's like planting the seeds, he's tying the thread through Travis's life. I love that.
Not totally supported by the other parts of the movie theory, but that like if he showed up one more time, it would be a stronger theory, but it's also
right.
It's
if he like walked through the crime scene at the end,
yes,
like
exactly.
He's in the melee around the cops,
or he
stuff.
Like shows up in Travis's cab at the end and winks at him, and then disappears in a puff of brimstone. But that's like, it's also a worse movie if the devil is an active participant in it. It's better as a thing that is in there just because, you know, it could, and also because Martin Scorsese at the time.
Yeah, that is of man.
Yes. And Scorsese at the time looked like Charles Manson. So that's the other thing. Like, yes. He looks almost exactly like Manson. But
he absolutely looks like a cult leader in this movie.
But this is a movie that, like, you can tell that it's made by guys who have felt this, and they are not necessarily, they're not approving of it. But they know what it's like. You know that Martin Scorsese is expressing the worst part of himself, that Paul Schrader, who wrote it, is expressing the worst, loneliest parts of himself. And, like, it's a movie that feels really, really grimy and gross in the way of 70s movies, but it's told in such an artful way. Like, watching again, I'm like, oh, well, this is like the most beautifully hideous movie in a lot of ways. But also that, like, you can tell the people making this are not like, look at this strange character. Like, let's look at him from the outside. They're like, hey, we've been this guy. Guys in the audience, you know you've been this guy. But I think what you were getting at earlier, that, like, the arc of this character is something that we've now seen in real life so many times.
Yeah, and it at the time when that came out, that was part of its uniqueness. Yes. Like,
The only other movie I can think of that's kind of similar in that way is Targets, which was, because I think the big case before this was, what's his name, who went up to that bell tower in Texas and shot a bunch of people. But this idea of a lonely young man who is sexually frustrated, does not have human connections, and feels isolated. And the only guys he spends time with, and this are his co-workers, are other guys who play with the kind of, like, hate that he feels in his heart. These other guys kind of play with casually. Like, they have other things in their lives. Peter Boyle's character, Wizard, has a family and is – there's a scene here. He tries to give advice to Travis, and what he says is so incomprehensibly
– incomprehensible. Like, nothing.
Like,
it's
the
nothing.
Worst advice.
I got some bad ideas in my head. I just – go on, get laid. Get drunk. You know, do anything. Because you got no choice anyway. I mean, we're all fucked. More or less, you know? I don't know. That's about the dumbest thing I ever heard.
And there's another guy who will do anything for a dollar, but where they're kind of playing with these things, whereas they're at the heart of Travis, and Travis has nothing else to go with. And so it's like, it's one of those things where it's like, oh, well, yeah, if this guy got on Reddit, he'd find the other guys like him, and then it would have taken him half the movie to start killing people, you know. But the thing is, it's like I hadn't thought about this until now. This is a thing that must have been in men for forever, because once he's lonely and he goes, I need a purpose. I need something basically to make me feel like more than a nobody. And he decides he's going to assassinate a presidential candidate. And it reminds me of
Senator Palentine.
Senator Palentine.
Who is a politician that Sybil Shepherd's Betsy works for.
Yeah. It's so well done the way he's like, I'm sexually focused on this woman. She's rejected me. So I'm going to kill her boss. And that's also going to, like, and
I'm going to kill the most powerful man in her life.
Yes.
Is what I'm going to do.
Yeah. And there's a, yeah, exactly. And there's a scene in War and Peace, the novel, where Pierre, one of the main characters, he falls into this kind of paranoid loneliness where he's like, I know what I was put on this earth to do, to assassinate Napoleon. That's my job on this earth.
Okay.
And it doesn't work out, and he kind of breaks out of that funk pretty quickly. But it's like, oh, wait a minute. Like, so 200 years ago, dudes were going through the same thing where they're like, I need to prove I'm someone more than just kind of a loser. I'm going to be a historical figure. I guess I'm going to assassinate. I have to react with violence. That's the only way I can make my mark. Historic violence. And that it's, yeah. But now we're living in this world where guys don't shake their way out of it quite as much, it seems, which is terrible. Where they have more access to
lot of access to a lot more ways to hurt people.
Yes.
And it was interesting watching this and see, like, he's writing his manifesto basically in his journal, like, throughout the course of the movie. And he decides at a certain point, like, he enters this sort of purity phase where his body is a temple. He's discovered his purpose and drive. He's going to assassinate this man.
Mm-hmm.
He's been rejected by this woman. He starts to work out again. No more bad food. It's clean living.
Yeah.
No more pills.
Clean living, which involves just holding his fist over a flame for as long as he can to test how strong he is. And
absolutely, absolutely. You know, you have this guy who's, he can't sleep. He is ruined with the thought of how filthy this city is. He goes out, Palentine ends up in his cab, and he's like, we gotta clean up this city. Like, he says, like, you know, a great rain's gotta come, it's gotta wash it away.
I think that the president should just clean up this whole mess here. He should just flush it right down the fucking toilet.
It's such a beautiful moment where he's saying, you know, whoever's president, you should just clean this place up, flush it down the fucking toilet, like a rain's going to come and clean it up. He's so mad. And Palpatine does not respond to it. And he goes, you know,
I
I've learned
more about America from riding in taxi cabs than in all the limos in the country.
He just gives him this empty pablum.
Platitude.
It's an empty platitude that he says probably to every taxi driver he encounters.
100%.
But also it is, it's such a, like, that moment. I realized that that this came a few years after the wave of political assassinations in the United States, which I should have mentioned earlier. But that, like, this moment where I feel like that moment plays differently now when we have seen politicians in the Republican Party, certainly. I mean, now they're directly encouraging violence, it feels like. But from so many years, accepting that their voters are violent, they're not going to call attention to it, they're not going to try to tell them to stop. Not since that one moment when John McCain told that woman at a rally, no, Barack Obama's not a bad man and he's not a Muslim terrorist. That was the last time in 2008. And ever since then, it's just been like, we want their votes. They're angry, unstable people, and we're just going to let them say what they say and not tell them not to. And it feels like that moment, it's like when I was a more naive viewer when I was an adolescent, it's like, oh, Palpatine's probably a good guy. He comes off as like a, you know, the person you see running for president, and then getting older and being like, oh, he's nothing. He's everything he says is empty. It's just empty.
he's a fucking dick.
Yeah, and in this scene, he is very much like, I'm seeing a problem. I don't want to deal with it, and I want him to vote for me. So I'm just going to let it happen, and I'm not going to I'm not going to do anything about it. And just how it allows that kind of thing to fester in a society, and it's like, oh, okay, well, that's what, and then eventually you get millions of people who exist in a kind of different reality where they have no incentive to leave and join the rest of us. It's just like, I don't know. There's so much, watching this movie again, it was a lot of like, I always feel the weird comfort when I watch old things and see modern problems in them, the weird comfort of being like, oh, this isn't a new thing. This is something that's been around forever. But also the discomfort of being like, oh, we really should have known this was an issue. Like, so this isn't
we've
a new thing.
We had all the clues, Mr. Police Officer.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, the snowman was telling us what to do.
What I was really dealing with when I was watching it this time was like feeling so much hatred for Travis Bickle.
Well, that's the thing. That's the thing I want to hear from you also is like, I imagine watching this movie as a woman is probably such a different experience than watching it as a man. Like, I want to hear how this movie plays for a woman, because for a man it is, for me at least, it was like, oh, all the worst instincts in me that as a human, as a man who wants to live in a nice world and be nice to people, that I have to push back against and kind of vomit out of myself away from other people as much as possible. I wonder if to be watching the movie and be like, oh, I'm the object of that, of those feelings. Like, how does that feel as a woman? I'm very curious. Yeah.
It's a perfect example to me. Like, watching it, I was like, I was hating him so much throughout the movie, but then like, and mad at Martin Scorsese for it, kind of being like, wow, kind of fuck you, man, for this being like one of the but then like, you know, it hits a point where he finds Iris and you feel yourself soften to him as he wants to save this child, even as misguided as he is. And I was like, okay, wow, no, you actually pulled off a phenomenally balancing act here where I do feel like I'm seeing the cold truth of the reality of, like you said, of Paul Schrader pouring himself and his loneliness into this, of Martin Scorsese pouring himself and his angerness and his loneliness into this, and being like, this depiction is accurate, and that is why it is making me as furious as it
is. That's why it's getting that. They're really forcing you to confront this guy that you would rather not deal with or exist in the same world as. But anyway, you were saying, I interrupted
you. No, not at all. It lives to me as a perfect example of why I don't feel compelled to engage a ton, like, in casual, like, film conversation with, like, 70s movies. Obviously, the 70s is the beginning of, like, the modern filmmaking era and auteurs and all of these filmmakers. Yes. But what I feel is what I feel sort of beat over the head with by the sort of test your mettle of film love and knowledge about being asked and quizzed and interrogated about the film of the 70s is like, look, fuckers, it was a bunch of dudes making movies that made me objects, and there's a lot of great stuff happening in them. But yes, I will leave that mostly for other people to scrutinize and litigate and relitigate, and me be like, hey guys, just so you know, watching this movie, I feel like no matter, this guy could have had the world collapsing around him. Like, he's carrying war trauma, most likely. He is filled with anxiety and dread and hatred about the world around him. He's racist. He's homophobic. But at the end of the day, the thing that pushed him over the edge was him setting up a bad date and a woman having the presence of mind and the confidence in herself to walk out mid-date and not be like, I'm going to ride this out for the rest of the night and just leave this guy and read. She's like, I'm leaving in the middle of this. You took me to porn. That's weird. Before we got even into the theater, I was like, why are we at a porn theater? This is a dirty movie. And you're like, no, it's fine. It's fine. I watch these movies all the time. It's like, yo, mom, not you, Travis. And so
that's always the moment in the movie where I'm like, what are you doing, Travis? You know, this is not something you should be doing, Travis. This is a bad idea.
We're going to take a quick break and we will be right back with a lot more Elliot Kalin movie talk. So stay tuned.
Hi, I'm Janet Varney, and just like you, I survived high school. And we're not alone. On my podcast, The JV Club, I invite some of my friends to share the highs and lows of their teen years, like moments with Aisha Tyler.
But when you're a kid, the stakes are just pretty low. Go to school, try not to get in trouble, get laid.
Jamila Jamil.
I watched television probably every waking hour during that time when I was shit-faced on medicine.
And Dave Holmes.
We talked and talked, and then everybody left. It was just us two, and I was like, I love you.
Learn how you too can be a functioning adult after the drama and heartbreak of high school. Every week on the JV Club with Janet Varney. Find it on Maximum Fun or wherever you get your podcasts. This is a judgment-free show.
Hi, I'm Biz, host of One Bad Mother. Whether you're a parent or just know kids exist in the world, join us each week as we honestly share what it's like to be a parent.
I signed my stepson up for a camp that is actually in another state. I feel really stupid, and I don't think we're going to get the money back.
And then he found out that the car manual is a book about cars, so now he's reading our car manual.
So join us each week as we judge less, laugh more, and remind you that you are doing a great job. Download One Bad Mother on MaximumFun.org, and yes, there will be swears.
Welcome back to Feeling Seen. You've got two talkative movie freaks on today's program. So let's get right back into our conversation with Elliot Kalin about Martin Scorsese's Taxi Driver. Then at the end, look forward to a little bit of a different spin on the one quick thing before we go. So let's get back to it. The very ending of this movie is kind of what killed me watching it this time, because I was like, I'm on board with the journey of this movie, but this end where he just killed all these people and she's just like finds his cab and gets in and is like having a moment of eye contact with him. I was like, absolutely the fuck not. This woman might be like, listen, I don't mind. Like, vigilantes need to clean up the streets. We can't trust law enforcement. There's a very appropriate, like, you know, the cops don't do shit moment in Taxi Driver that Travis says to Iris, the 12 and a half year old prostitute played by an incredible Jodie Foster.
She's so good. And it's the scene with the two of them talking in the diner. Watching it this time, it's like, I forgot how late in the movie she really becomes a full character.
Yes!
And that scene in the diner where she is such a realized person.
It's unreal, Elliot. I rewound the whole scene. I was like, I gotta do this again. I can't believe what I've just watched. And I've seen this movie before.
Are you a narc?
Do I look like a narc?
Yeah.
I am a narc.
God. I don't know who's weirder, you or me.
It's an amazing scene. And that she's, and what really came through me this time is how much she is, like, she is dealing with her own levels of kind of, like, wanting to buy into the delusion that Travis is putting before her. And how desperate she is for real human connection and not just being used by sport, Harvey Keitel. Mm-hmm. That she is, that the minute someone shows an interest to her in her that is not, he is using her because he's using her as another object, another female object that he can save or be the hero for. But who is not using her in the same way that she's used to being used, that she she's so quick to glom onto it, but she's such like a real kid.
Where she, there's that moment where she just does that little thing with her mouth where she just goes, ah!
Yeah.
I was like, oh my God, you're real. Iris is real. Jodie Foster who?
Yeah.
Like, this is a completely real character with tics and mannerisms and habits. Like, I was blown and she has, and away she, and by how good she is.
In such a short amount of screen time. But it's funny, I was reading an interview with her that she did, like, it was for the 40th anniversary of the movie, so it was like 6 years ago. And she was saying mm-hmm. how they were like, were you nervous at all making this movie with Robert De Niro? And she's like, well, at that point, I had made more movies than Robert De Niro. I had made more movies than Martin Scorsese. She's like, I'd been acting since I was little, so I'd been in like 10 or 11 or 12 movies. And this was Martin Scorsese's fourth movie. And that she talks about Robert De Niro wow. like taking her out to diners, just the two of them, and really like mm. running her, like she was like, we ran through the lines and then we did improv, and I had never really done improv before, and that like he did help her build a character, I guess. But the idea that like, well, was it intimidating? And it's like, well, at the time he was not yet like a huge star, and I had been in movies since I was a kid, like
she's
a baby.
Like, I knew
basically.
My way around a set better than he did.
Yeah,
yeah,
exactly.
Like...
But you're right. The movie is, and this is something that is not a problem if everyone has their crack at making movies. The movie is very much
right.
for one type of person. And if yes. everyone has their crack at making movies, but you're right, that whole generation in the 70s, aside from like Elaine May and like a few other like female filmmakers, you know, it's like, otherwise it's just these dudes, these nerdy bros making movies. And I feel like—
And these nerdy bros are making really good movies. And it's the fact that I don't have anything else in the landscape as far as demographics that produced something is where it becomes like, that's where it becomes, it fucking sucks because it's like the movie becomes like, in hindsight, the movie comes in part responsible for the one-dimensional legacy of the composition of filmmakers at that time at a level that were like widely available and known to larger audiences.
Yeah.
Even like the movie shouldn't have to have those things in consideration when it is coming to be because it needs to be true and the art needs to be honest. But I can't dissociate it now from the lack of
from
texture
anything
and
else.
Variety that it is around it to be like, I know that when this movie ends, Sybil Shepherd's not going to go and have her own taxi driver.
No.
Like, Sybil Shepherd will go on to have a wonderful career. But it's watching it and being like, wait, you're going to really make her like get in the cab at the end of this movie and kind of give him his happy ending where like he was just a guy who did a job.
That's the one scene that has never worked for me, because it feels like what they're trying to do at the end there, it feels like, is now that his violence has been lionized by society and he should be put away for the rest of his life, but instead he's back to normal and he's a ticking time bomb. And like, they establish that with that pan of newspaper articles, which are the best fake newspaper articles I think I've ever seen. They look like they were clipped out of newspapers. Like, and then, but I think the Sybil Shepherd scene, here's my overt and uncovert intentions, I think, for it.
Okay.
I think the filmmaker's overt intention was, now Travis is a hero and society wrongly sees him as a hero. The covert intent, or maybe overt, Paul Schrader's a weird dude. I mean, he has so many great movies in his career, but he has also some terrible ones. But he is such a, I feel like there are very few other filmmakers who are as much like, here's the worst part of my soul, onto the film.
Yeah.
And, but the possibly covert, possibly not, is this bitch, she wouldn't even look at me. She wouldn't even care about me. But now that I'm a big man, suddenly she wants to be mine. You know what? I'm just going to leave her be. I'm not going to give her the satisfaction, which is disgusting, which is gross.
That is what it feels like.
And it's the moment. And it's the moment where the movie stops empathizing without sympathizing and just starts sympathizing. Where up to that point, it's like, I feel like the filmmakers are trying to say, like, I felt this way. If you're a man, you felt this way. Isn't it terrible? It's not good, but it doesn't feel good to feel that way. And by the end, it's like, yeah, Travis, you did it. And it's like, oh, that's gross. I don't like that.
It feels like it almost came from a different director.
Yes. Yeah.
Like, it is so out of step with what feels like the balance the rest of the movie is walking, to where you get to that last scene and it is just like backpats.
Yeah.
And it's like, whoa, when did this become a hero's journey?
Yeah.
Because now it's a hero's journey
and
not an anti-hero's journey.
No. And it's, I'm usually not a fan of when people are like, the rest of this, from this part on, the movie is his dream while he's in a coma or some nonsense. Like, I hate that stuff. But it's like, this is the one time where I'm like, you know what? If the filmmakers were like, oh, no, he dies he's dying in that shootout and his last moments are imagining himself as a hero and he's imagining that Betsy wants to be with him. Like, I'd be like, all right, I'll give you that out. I don't think that's the case. And they've said, they're like, no, the end of it is what happens. For me, at least, you know, as a man who felt this horrible loneliness, and thankfully by the grace of God and the lack of the internet when I was young, like, did not fall off of that tightrope into this abyss of, like, sexualized political violence, you know? That's the moment where it, like, slips on the tightrope and it falls in. Mm-hmm. Up to that moment, I feel like it's walked that tightrope really well of, like, we're going to show this. We're going to show it as honestly, emotionally as we can, but we're not asking you to like this guy. And at the end, they're not necessarily asking you to like Travis, but they are asking you to hate Betsy. And up to that moment, they're asking you to be
like, isn't she a fucking bitch? Like, you feel like you're entering the point of view of a group of bros talking about chicks. Whereas the rest of the movie does not feel like a group of bros talking about chicks. It feels like a voyeuristic experience into watching men communicate, like, how they do in this state of, like, disgruntled men.
There's a little bit of that, and there's parts of the movie where it feels like, oh, this is what men would talk about with each other if they felt comfortable. They would talk about, instead of talking about, like, anyway, so this chick was in the back of my cab and I jumped back and banged her. They would talk about, like, I spend my day and I don't know who I am and I don't know why I'm here and I'm wandering around and I just sit in my apartment all day just watching TV and connecting to nobody and I don't know what I'm doing with my life. Like, I feel like, but instead men, but then the end becomes the conversation. It becomes the conversation that they're having in that all night diner. Yeah. Where it's like, yeah, so this chick got into my cab and she really wanted me, you know, like,
yeah.
Ugh. But the shootout before that is so horrifying that almost like they're like, nobody's going to be paying complete attention after that anyway. They're going to be like, everyone's running for the vomit bags. Because I remember the first time I watched it, there's a very bad special effect in the shootout, but it's still
with
the hand. But it's still the first time I saw it, I like barked laughing. But it was because of how shocked I was at, like, seeing that happen right in front of the camera. That, like, even though it looks very fake, just the idea that this hand is blown apart in front of me. Like, because Travis, he decides he's going to save, he can't kill that senator. So he's going to save Iris the prostitute by.
He can't kill the senator. Yeah. He can't have sex with Betsy. So he's going to save a little girl.
Yeah. And so he goes on this rampage where right in front of her, he murders the John she's with, her pimp, and the guy who rents out rooms at the building. And it's so funny. There's I spent so much time in New York in the area where they shot the movie, like, just because I went to NYU and NYU is right over there. And so, like, he drives a bunch of times past the Variety Playhouse, which is like a, I think it's a porno theater in the movie, but I can't remember. But by the time I was in New York, it was a legitimate theater where they had plays and things like that. But it still had the same sign, Variety, and it's closed since then, but because I'm an old man and that was 20 years ago. But he goes on this rampage and it's horrifying. There's nothing cathartic about it. I mean, I'm sure there are creeps who watch
it. Iris doesn't like leap into his arms. She begs him not to shoot a man's, like, brains out the back of his head in front of her. Yeah. She's crying. She's wailing. She's screaming. She's hiding.
And Travis tries to kill himself at the end of it and can't pull it off because his gun is out of bullets. And, like, everything about it is, and it's shot like a, it's not shot in a cool way. There's no, like, everyone is kind of stumbling around. Travis is not like this unholy avenger who kind of can wade through bullets without getting hit. Like, he gets shot a bunch of times.
He keeps getting shot at close range.
Yeah. Like, his arm doesn't work at one point. Like, he spends a good part of one part of the movie building this thing to go on his wrist where it's a cast with a sliding rack that he took from a drawer and so that he can attach a gun to it so he can snap his arm and a gun will slide into his hand. And when he finally uses that thing, like, it's not cool at all. Like, it looks like he's sitting on the ground in his own blood and, like, then shoots a man through the face a bunch of times and the bullets are just, that part is also horrifying where the bullets just kind of plip, plip, plip into the guy's face and he stumbles back. Yep. There's nothing cool about the scene at all. It's so horrifying. And I give the movie so much credit for that they were like, this is not cool. What he's doing is not cool. We've been kind of in his.
And he's not an assassin. He's just a fucking mess.
Yeah, he's a mess. He's a stumbling, crazy mess. And pardon my use of the word crazy. They're like, we're with this guy. We're in his mind. We are not in his mind for this scene. We are going to watch him from the outside. But then we're back in his mind again when Betsy gets in his cab. Mm-hmm. Like the studio was like, well, we need a happy ending to this movie. We can't just end with Travis miming, shooting himself with blood dripping from his hands. And then like the weirdos of downtown Manhattan, like, hanging around the apartment trying to see what's happening. Like, but I'm not going to say it's a perfect movie, but it's
sure. But like, no, but it's important. It's important. And it, like, there is, I think there is such a, there is such an incredible value in watching something like this now and being like, face value for something like this is dangerous.
Yes,
the
yes.
kind of thing where, like, you take the takeaway from it is I'm going to be Travis Bickle for Halloween. And, like, hey, Halloween costumes have a great time. But at the same, it's a thing of, like, watching The Purge and thinking, like, I should go buy a gun.
Yes.
Like, James DeMonico would be horrified. Like, watching this and being like, you know, there's something to that Travis guy. Instead of being like, you know, that Travis resonates with me. It's like, that Travis had some good ideas.
Oh, that Travis has the, you know what? That's what I need to do. And I think I think that was a big part of my growing up was part of me realizing, oh, Travis is not the hero of this movie. That, like, realizing, like, just because I relate to this character, and the purpose of the movie is for me to relate to this character, doesn't mean I am supposed to like or admire or, you know, or sympathize in terms of like, oh, I want a good thing. I want this character to succeed. You know, I realized I matured. It was literally last night. I was saying to my wife that I was recording this today, and I was mentioning I'm going to talk about Taxi Driver, and I just watched it again, and I still, you know, it hit me in the way that it did before, but it looked differently. And she was like, you know what? I've never seen it. And I was like, you don't have to. Whereas, like, when I was a younger version of me, would have been like, what? Okay, we got to watch it tomorrow. But knowing that, like, this is an unpleasant movie, like, it's not, I don't think she's going to get much out of it, except that feeling, like you're saying, of like, why are men so horrible? Like, you know, it's not going to teach her anything new.
It's incredible how many ways you don't even have to look when you're a woman or a non-gender normative person, like when you're a woman, to look at things and realize how many ways you can find to have it communicated that men hate you.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
At like a inside visceral core soul level.
But that it's so common and it's so taken for granted in the minds of men that you could have it becomes a major movie that is nominated for Best Picture where the purpose of it is, hey, this is about how much men are afraid of and hate women and how that only comes out in violence. I don't know. It's really horrible, but I'm not going to be able to solve it today. I'll work on it, but you know.
No, I do. I guess my question to you specifically around that would be, did you realize, like, when you were younger and you were experiencing this sense of, like, sort of out to sea, like watching Travis and feeling like this was a person who made sense to you? Did you
not his conclusions, but his motivations made sense to me? Yeah,
right, the sort of, like, it seems like the emptiness is there, the sort of maybe search for purpose and the loneliness
and the need for this inability to kind of differentiate for a lot of, especially I'm going to generalize just based on my own past, especially men who grow up on a certain type of entertainment culture or a certain type of media culture, this difficulty with separating romantic love from sexuality and validation from another person's either love or attraction to you, or and this idea, this difficulty separating that, all that stuff, also from the idea of conquest or, you know, victory in a way that, like, this is a competition between men and that kind of thing. That's a competition between you and the women of the world to prove your worth by getting them to sleep with you, and it's a competition between you and all men in the world to prove your worth to them with the women that you've gotten to sleep with. Like, that there's all that stew that I feel like goes back to the beginning of human civilization, or at least the beginning of whenever that mythical time when supposedly the men realized they were stronger physically and they overthrew the matriarchal farming culture and imposed their horrible 10,000-year reign of terror. Like this. So anyway, you were saying as someone who was kind of feeling those types of things, you know,
you could identify, like, that you can identify in your sort of teen self at the time. Yeah. Were you feeling elements of that maelstrom kind of just, like, loosed in your mind? Was that sort of part of what you felt adrift by? Was it that sort of, like, economy of sexuality and that sort of pressure?
Oh, yeah, very much so. A very big part of it. And there's that idea of, like, incels now, where it's like, and sexual economy.
That word was absolutely in my mind the whole time. While I was watching this.
Because that's what he is. The idea that you are owed a certain amount of something from the world and from women, and if you don't get it, then either there's a big problem with you, or there's a problem with society and there's a problem with you, and it's going to take some kind of action to solve that problem. And the action that you should be taking is to civilize yourself so that you are more, the reason you'll be more attractive to women when you're, like, when you're like a better person, you know, but the, and at least I say to myself, well, these are things I had at least when I was a young man, like as a grown up, I don't feel this way. I feel like it is on me to show the world that I deserve things rather than on the world to just give it to me.
You talking to me? You talking to me? You talking to me? Well, then who the hell else are you talking to? You talking to me? Well, I'm the only one here.
I wouldn't want Taxi Driver to be different. And I wouldn't want the chronicle of that truth, of that kind of individual, I would not want us to be spared that in its hideous reality, because it is crucial that we see.
But like you were saying, when that's the only thing on when that's the only thing on the menu, it's not good.
Yeah.
I think one of the things that really I think was looking back powerful about it was also like this was a movie that showed me that like a great movie can be unpleasant, that like it can be something that is not like a thrill ride or like fun or that where you leave it, you feel worse than when you started. And that also opened up a whole world of once I saw Taxi Driver, it was like I was ready for like Ingmar Bergman movies where I was going to watch them and afterwards I'd feel bad and I'd be like, so in a way, by showing me a very unpleasant movie, a very ugly movie that I directly related to, it kind of opened this door for me to be able to watch unpleasant or sad or ugly movies about people who are not like me and being able to like take that emotion. My Flophouse co-host Dan McCoy, he always likes to quote Roger Ebert's thing that movies are empathy machines, which I think is not true, which is if Roger Ebert was here, he's not because he's dead now, but if he was here, then I would say that to Leni Riefenstahl. I do think that but some movies can act that way, and it feels like Taxi Driver kind of opened that door for me of saying like, this movie is showing you things that you feel that you never saw presented this honestly before. There are movies out there that I present other people's feelings honestly, and you're going to be able to appreciate those too. So I owe it something for that. I mean, most of those movies were still made by men, and it wouldn't be a long time until there was more of those made by women. But I feel like there's a world of movies that I think I would not have been, that this was the gateway to, that I'm very glad that I can now exist in, you know, and that I can, I now have the tools to watch a movie that makes me feel bad, but to be like, I'm glad I watched that. Like, I got a lot out of that, you know?
Yeah. I am grateful for you being handed the keys to cinema at the young age in your life. And I'm grateful to you for coming on and talking about the less noble aspects of the way we see ourselves in movies. And I watched the show Girls and I was like, Marnie, this wild, out of her mind bitch who is just obsessed with, like, I was like, well, here's my representation. It's Marnie. So like that, like, listen, it's a thing I want to do on the show more and more and more, is talk about sort of, you know, the ugly ways that we can see ourselves and reckon with that and mine through that. So Elliot, I really, really appreciate you coming on and doing that with me. I'm very grateful for you taking the time.
Thank you so much for having me. I was really looking forward to doing this and I enjoyed the talk so much, and I feel like, I don't know what your listeners will feel, but I feel like I got a lot out of it, and it's,
I feel like I did.
Oh, good. I'm glad. And I hope I, as much as possible, fought the instinct that still rears up in me, like the Loch Ness monster's head peeking above the surface of the water and then hopefully diving back down when the tourists see it, to like lecture or test or any of those things. It's a thing. It's a thing all men have to fight against for constantly. And it's such a, and this is,
I feel it.
I know this is like wham wham pampers, like a baby crying, but it's like, it's such a burden to always have to deal with these terrible feelings that I have to, you know, that I have to tamp down. There's sometimes something about seeing the worst, at least for me, seeing the worst part of myself presented fictionally, that it's not as enjoyable, but almost as powerful as seeing the best part, because it's like, then once you see it, once it's been identified for me, at least, I feel like I can be like, oh, now I have a name I can put to it. And I know the thing not to do. To try not to be. Yeah.
We all have the numbers on the dial. It's just how we fine tune ourselves throughout our lives. Pretending those aspects aren't there does not get us any further toward our best selves. It just limits our ability to control and refine the attributes about ourselves that are sort of like the most productive and loving and altruistic, while letting the sort of vices creep through every now and again.
Yeah. Here's the really positive lesson I'm going to take from Taxi Driver. Hearing you say that, it makes me think of this. So like I was saying earlier on, like, oh, I'm really Tom. I'm not Travis. I'm Tom. And Tom is not the star of the movie. He's not the hero. of the movie? He's not the villain of the movie. He's just a guy who happens to be in the movie. He shows up in a bunch of scenes. So, like, yeah. If that's probably what I am in life. I'm not the hero of the story. I'm not the villain of the story. I'm just a guy who shows up for a bunch of scenes. And if I can keep that in mind, then I feel like I can really move towards the best part of me. If I can make those few scenes, like, I'm going to be as good as I can be in those few scenes and then not worry about being the great man of history. Like, oh, what freedom, what a liberating feeling.
And that is to me the perfect way to go out on this. So thank you, Elliot, for your time.
Thank you
today.
So much.
I really appreciate it. Thank you again so much to Elliot Kalin for coming on and sharing so much with us. Men, you can come on and be vulnerable on the Feeling Seen pod. The Flop House comes out every Saturday and is another Maximum Fun production. Elliot and I had such a great time talking about movies that we kind of couldn't stop. And we talked for over an hour, and there was so much fun stuff that we, you know, doesn't make it to the show sometimes. But normally I go on my little one quick thing rant at the end on my own. But you know what? This is a very special episode of One Quick Thing Before We Go, because it's going to be a little snippet from the conversation we just had. Consider this like your bonus features, your bonus content of the Elliot Kalin conversation tacked on at the end here, because we had a little bit too much to say about not Taxi Driver, aka the movie Joker, and we couldn't leave it on the cutting room floor. So this week's One Quick Thing is Jordan Cruciola featuring Elliot Kalin tag teaming Joker for you guys. I remember watching Joker and being like, so it's Taxi Driver.
Yes.
Like,
oh, I mean, made Taxi it's Driver. Exactly Taxi Driver, except not it's except not good. It, like, it's
just fucking Taxi Driver. But like, it is fascinating to, and I think that's a thing that does get me about these movies too. Just like, I deal with this frustration is like, it feels like watching a fucking 15-year-old boy's interpretation of what it's difficult about being a man in this world, when it's like, you guys, you're like your 30s or 40s now. Why is this still happening? Because like, you're sitting here watching it being like, yeah, that made total sense to me when I was an adolescent.
When I was an adolescent.
And now you're an adult man being like, that's not the way. But and yet it's like these things crystallize and they get brought forth. And it's like, well, now I'm a guy and I'm adult and I can make movies. So I'm going to make my 13-year-old fantasy. It's like, but in the body of a grown ass man.
Yeah. Well, it's kind of like there's a thing someone said once that like every band is trying to be the band they liked when they were 13. And I think it's kind of like that. And at a certain point, it becomes with Joker, I felt like it was like, it wasn't even just I'm expressing the things I felt as a teenager. It's I want to make the movie I liked when I was a teenager. And so I'm going to make Taxi Driver. And like, the most radical thing they could have done with that movie, and also the most relevant thing, is to not set it in the past, but to set it now.
Yeah.
And have that, if you're going to make that movie, have that and do that character, have that character be living in this world, because it's not a past problem. You can't blame it on how New York or Gotham or whatever was falling apart in the 70s. Also, that movie was such a... that movie was such a tease, because by the end of it, I was like, okay, I'm kind of curious to see what kind of crimes this Joker character is going to come up with. Credits. Movie's over. Like, it was like, I don't really care about him before he's the Joker. But anyway, but that's
no, I don't.
But you're right. It's just Taxi Driver. And I think in that case, it is, was it Todd Phillips? It's Todd Phillips. I think partly it's him being like, see, I can do serious stuff. But it's also like, him, I love this movie. I want to make this movie. And that's kind of the difference, I feel like, between the 70s studio guys and these studio guys is Paul Schrader and Martin Scorsese will watch like The Searchers and The Wrong Man, and they'll be like, what's the emotional core of that? Okay, I'm going to do that for now. Whereas now it's like, I'm going to watch this movie from the 70s. This is cool. I'm going to make a movie set in the 70s that's just like this, you know? instead of ingesting it and processing it and then, you know, pooping it out as their own thing, it's just like, yeah, let me do it. It becomes like cover stuff, basically, you know. And that's and that's why we were, before the recording, we were razzing Zack Snyder a little bit, but I'll say this about Zack Snyder is that some of his movies, he's just wearing his influences right there on his sleeve, but every now and then he'll make a movie where I'm like, oh, you did ingest your influences and then process them and then poop them out in a new way. I don't like it. But it is but it's not for me. It's not something I enjoy. But it's certainly your thing that you made.
You made it yours.
Yeah, you made it yours.
You made it unmistakably yours.
Oh man, that Joker movie. There was so, that was a movie where, so what sums up that movie to me is the experience I had where there was that tweet that was going around where someone was like, one of the greatest moments in cinema, the birth of the Joker, and it was him dancing on the stairs, and I refused to click on it. I couldn't hear the volume. So it was always this clip that would come up on Twitter and I wouldn't hear what the song was, but I assumed it was something momentous or operatic. And then I finally watched the movie because I had to watch it for the Flophouse, and to see that the music was that's exactly what it was. I was like, what is this fucking movie? they chose the dumbest, broiest song. And I don't think it's meant as a joke or as like a comment. I think it's meant as like, this is a cool moment. He's finally doing it. Like, it was that music. I was like, my head was in a different place than this movie was, certainly, you know.
I feel like a perfect example of, like, the maturation of this conceit of, like, the Travis Bickle kind of character. Mm-hmm. And, like, shows me the world of possibility that exists now where standing on the shoulders of giants, like, people besides guys who look like Martin Scorsese can make movies. I like the Joker better when it was made the first time with the exact same, like, structuring almost, when it was Lynn Ramsey's You Were Never Really Here.
Oh, see, I still haven't seen You're Never Really... I've still got to watch...
Literally a New York City shut-in who lives in a hovel apartment with his mom, who is a social outcast from the world around him, who goes on a journey to, like, save a little girl, so it's even, like, Taxi Driver. Mm-hmm. But, like, I accept the Oscar win for Joaquin Phoenix for Joker because I consider it a win for You Were Never Really Here, which just didn't make $1 billion. And I watched that and I'm like, see, this is why I can watch Taxi Driver and like get angry about it and embrace it and then watch a movie decades later where we have a woman making a movie with Joaquin Phoenix who takes the same character and like manages to me to express the same experience of like isolation and detachment and dissociation, but imbues it with so much more of like a not schlocky, not overt, but like sort of tenderness and absence of misogyny.
Yeah, without the hate. The hate for women that's baked into it. Yeah.
Yeah, it doesn't feel like it hates women. And so I'm like, oh my God, like did I get my Taxi Driver in like 2018?
It's possible.
In a Joaquin Phoenix movie? It's like it can work on all these levels. And so like watching, if I only had Taxi Driver, I would probably hate Taxi Driver, honestly. Mm-hmm. I'd be like, this fucking guy, I can see him on the street, I can see him on the news. But knowing that I can have a You Were Never Really Here makes me be like, but when both can exist as like a yin and a yang to one another, then my universe can be in balance.
I think that's fair. That's fair. Both. Hearing you say that makes, I'm probably going to queue it up next. That'll be the next movie that I watch.
I really hope you like it. And that's our show. A spicy little mix-up on the normal formula. You can follow us on Twitter at FeelingScenePod or send us an email at feelingscene@maximumfun.org. If you want to follow me, I'm JorCrew on Twitter. That's JorCru. Our theme music is by Andrew Epen. The show is produced by Marissa Flaxbart, and our senior producers are Kevin Ferguson and Laura Swisher. And this is a production of Maximum Fun.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned. Audience supported.